unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I hope you all found your heaters. Some of you up at Farmers didn't find your heaters till this morning, and it was a little chilly. I'm sorry. Should have reminded you that they were in there somewhere. Well, we have so much to be grateful for, you know, the fall, winter rains coming, and the beautiful colors of this particular fall, and the opportunity to come and sit together and really feel and be with ourselves. That's a rare opportunity that not everybody is blessed with. And this beautiful room, I love to sit in this room. This is such a great place. And we need to appreciate all the things that we have every day. You know, there's a saying in the Lojong, be grateful for everything. And so part of our practice is to, of course, abate the self-centered mind and be receptive to what the world has to bring us. Because what I want to talk about today actually is explore a little bit about fear. So we need to cultivate gratitude, because when those things that are scary come upon us, we need to have some kind of reservoir, some kind of spiritual reservoir, in order to be with them. So I was thinking, in some ways, you know, Chris and I watch public television, and that's mostly where I get my news, and I watch it because they kind of titrate all the horrible things that are happening, you know, all the shootings and the acquisition of guns and the shooting of guns and all the sense of self-protection that's going on out there. In the news, at least they titrate it with usually they do an interview with some musician or some artist or something nice that's happening in the educational, how we're educating our kids in kind of new ways with more emotional literacy. But still, there's a lot of fear out there, and in our practice, we need to feel it and get in touch with it and not avoid it. I mean, it's not avoidable in the news. So, you know, we start with ourselves and feeling our own fear, and then it helps us a little bit, because what we see is a lot of anger, a lot of angry people. But if we can go a little deeper, we know that what behind is the anger is a sense of fear. And if we can feel that person's fear, it's helpful for us to develop a sense of compassion to what's actually happening in the world. You know, in metta practice, when we do metta practice, one of the ways that we build up our reservoir, it starts, the traditional phrases are, it starts, may I be free of fear, may you be free of fear. And then, and only then, do we usually move on to, may I be physically well, may I be mentally well, may I be peaceful and at ease, may I be happy at the end, may I be happy. And there's a reason why there's that sequence, because we really do need to get in touch, you know, with our anger and be able to be with it and to appreciate other people's anger. It's said that the Buddha actually taught the Metta Sutra because his monks were afraid to go out into the woods and into the forest to meditate. Too much unknown out there. So he taught the Metta practice as a way to soothe themselves and to prepare themselves. So being free of fear is praised in the Buddha Dharma. The Buddha Dharma is offered to us as a gift. One of the ways of giving, it said, one of the traditional ways of giving, besides, you know, food, clothing, shelter, is actually the Dharma and ways to alleviate fear in people. That's one of the gifts that we can give. And in fact, one of the Buddha's poses, the Abhya pose, you know, there's usually three traditional poses. There's the touching the earth pose of the Buddha, where he's grounding himself in this moment, in this reality. And then there's the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, where he's disseminating the Dharma. And then the other one is the Abhya pose, which is fearlessness, sending fearlessness out. And I thought, what a wonderful pose. You know, it must be something very archetypal about that. Isn't that what the Indians used? You know, peace. It's something about an open hand, or showing that you're willing to meet people with a sense of openness and open-handedness. And when I look at the statue of Buddha, it engenders in me a sense of fearlessness, calm, poised, a sense of equanimity. And so what is it about the Buddha that emanates that? Well, I think one is that in his practice, in his life, and cultivating the Dharma in himself, he came to a place where there was nothing to protect. You know, true, he had given up his home, his family. He was a home leaver, although his wife and his son actually later came and joined him, took vows and joined his community. But there's something about nothing to hang on to, nothing to protect, even a sense of some belief system, which is driving so much of the turmoil in the world today. My belief is the best belief, and your belief threatens my belief, and basically I'm afraid of your belief, because if I believe that there may be some truth in your belief, it threatens what I'm basing my whole substance on. And so I have to protect that. And the way I protect that is I have to destroy your belief system. It's too threatening to me. It's too scary for me. I mean, if you ask people, they wouldn't say it's scary. They would just say it's wrong. But if you go deeper, that's what's driving that. But also Buddha had a sense of he was so much bigger than his small self. He had entered a state, what we call, of deathlessness, which means that he knew that when he gave up this physical incarnation, that was not to be feared. There was something that was much bigger than this physical reality. In his meditation, he had tasted that, and he knew that to be true. You know, there's a Zen story that I think was very seductive to me when I first started practicing many, many years ago. It was in Paul Reps's book, which was the only book of koans that was available, and perhaps you're familiar with it, where like a terrorist of today, a samurai is rampaging through the village, and he runs up to forces his way into the local monastery, and there's this monk sitting there, and doesn't seem to pay him the appropriate amount of respect and fear. And he says, "You don't know who I am?" He says, "I am somebody that can run you through without blinking an eye." And the monk responds, "Well, I'm somebody that you can run through without blinking an eye." So that was very seductive, because that clearly wasn't where I was then and not where I am now. But it got me thinking, what kind of mental state could give rise to that statement? And so he, like Buddha, you know, had reached a place of where he could give it all up. He could give up, even if it was his life. But upon reflection over the years, I think another interpretation, maybe a more human interpretation, is that if you asked him, "Would you prefer to live?" he'd say, "Yeah, I prefer to live." But somehow in his meditation, moment after moment, accepting the death of this moment into the birth of the next, he had just come to accept that this is what was in front of him. And he just didn't have any tension around that, because he was so used to accepting one moment after the next. So, you know, in Buddhism, we're not looking for a state that's free of fear. And in fact, one of the definitions of a bodhisattva is somebody that cultivates their own inner resources enough where they can actually go forward and put themselves into states of fear, that they can actually absorb and have the capacity to absorb other people's fear. And you've experienced that with your children. When you have children that are frightened, you have a capacity to absorb their fear, to abate their fear just by your calm presence. And that's what's being asked of us in the world today. You know, we don't have a heaven in Buddhism. We don't have some place where it's going to be all safe. Heaven, you know, a Buddhist definition of heaven is more like, how do we learn to experience life in each moment? How can we learn to do that? And we start right here in this room on our cushion. It's interesting that in the Abhidharma, which was the first kind of synthesized form of Buddhist meditation psychology, you know, the monks sat down for hundreds of years and they synthesized states that were mental states that were healthy and mental states that weren't healthy. Clearly, anger and envy and greed and restlessness were not particularly healthy states. And states of love and expansiveness were good states. But it's interesting that fear is not included in one of those states, even though it's such a pervasive force in our life. And Robert Thurman, who's this, you know, great Tibetan scholar, his theory on this is that fear is complicated. On one hand, fear is appropriate. You know, it's embedded in our DNA. It helps us survive. There are times, if you're a parent, where you really need to be fearful for the welfare of your children. You need to be careful when you step out into traffic. So there's a certain amount of fear that's helpful. And even in the Dharma, you could say the fear, a little bit of fear, appropriate fear, is helpful. In the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha says there is suffering. There is suffering. And you need to have some aversion, appropriate aversion to that suffering. And that's a motivator for you to actually enter the Dharma. And so that moves us to the second noble truth. Well, how do we deal with this? How do we deal with the potential? How do we deal with our fear? And the second noble truth, depending on which interpretation, one says, well, your fear is driven by the fact you don't get what you want, greed. And that's what drives it. Another interpretation of that, you know, could be that you just can't accept the present moment the way it is. And that's where your suffering comes from. But I'm like the interpretation more that developed in the Mahayana, and that is that the more that we try to create an absolute self, the more that we put our energy into solidifying our own particular needs and wants at the exclusion of other people's needs and wants, me and you, the more we move into that kind of a posture with the world is where suffering happens. We increasingly alienate ourselves and we build up a fabric of fear around it to protect that sense of isolation. And so the second noble truth says that doesn't work. And so the Buddha then gives us the third noble truth, that there's a way out of this. The fourth noble truth is the eight ways. The eight ways of practicing in the world. Right view, right understanding. You know, and then all the other ones, right speech, right livelihood, right concentration, right mindfulness, all those other things, which basically are saying, asking us and encouraging us to get in touch with our own nobleness and the nobleness of other people. Not our differences, but what is our own, what are our similarities? What's our nobleness? And to begin to see ourselves not as something solid, locked down behind a belief system, but something that's much more flexible, that's moving, that's changing from moment to a moment. And so we're less like something that's rigid, something more that can sway and bend. And something, because we see that we're not something, something that is intrinsically relational and interwoven with the universe. All of these things of which we can have some experience in our meditation practice. And the more that you can develop and practice these things, it intensifies your sense of connection with the world. And you do not fear this connectedness. Because if you're really honest with yourself, a lot of the times we do fear connectedness. I mean, think about it, really. When you're invited to a party and you maybe don't know most of the people, don't you feel a little contraction there? Don't you have a sense of, well, are they going to accept me? Am I going to be okay? Is my sense of who we are, what I am? So we experience this all the time, the sense of fear of connectedness. So that's one reason I love retreats, because we can be with each other in this really intimate sense of connectedness, which I call beyond personality. We don't have to prove that we have this scintillating personality. All we have to do is just kind of prove that we can show up, you know. And we begin to appreciate the sense of kind of showing up. So we cultivate a sense of benevolence and goodwill. We do our gratitude practice, we do our meditation practice, our metta practice. And in meditation, what we're cultivating a sense of generosity and benevolence just by accepting moment after moment whatever presents itself to you. That's an act of love, a deep act of love for yourself. And not so easy. But as we do that, moment after moment in our meditation practice, we begin to build a reservoir of benevolence and goodwill for ourselves. You know, when you think we're celebrating Buddha's enlightenment, and that picture of Buddha sitting, touching the earth, grounding in this moment, and then maybe you've seen that. Did you see that movie? I don't remember if it was Scorsese's movie or the other movie with Keanu Reeves where they have him under the tree, you know, and he's almost has this kind of wall of benevolence and goodwill that he's cultivated. And then on the outside is Mara and all Mara's permutations, throwing spears and arrows of fear and anger and doubt. Well, those are things that Buddha actually had to work with. He actually had to work with fear and anger and doubt. You know, he didn't just suddenly was perfect from the beginning. But because of his practice, those spears and arrows, instead of meeting them with anger and resistance, the image is that he turns them into flowers. So in some ways, you know, Buddha did have to work with fear, and we have to work with our fear. I read a story about a couple of weeks ago about a Zen teacher that had been practicing for 40 years, and it was really normalizing. She said, well, every time I sign up for a 7-day retreat, I have a little bit of fear and apprehension. And maybe if you're honest, you had a little bit of that coming here, right? You know, what's this going to be like? What's my body? Can my body handle it? You know, what's pain going to be like? Can I handle the pain? Can I handle the containment? You know, so all these things. But there was something that motivated you to move into that sense of resistance. So we start with the fact that there is fear. You know, there's just a general sense, existential fear, that we know we're not going to always be around, that we're going to die, that we're going to change, that we're going to age, that we're going to get sick, that we're going to lose things. Because that's the nature of reality. That is going to happen. And we don't want to face that. And the way most of us face that, most people, is you build up a sense, a fortress around yourself, a protection, to what we call usually the mundane treasures. The mundane treasures are wealth, prestige, big name for yourself. These are the ways that you usually build it up, build up a sense of protection around the uncertainty of the universe. And that's why we call them kind of the mundane treasures, because they work and we need them. But if we try to build too much of our identity around them, they don't work. It's a little like one teacher said, if you have fear and you try to only use the mundane treasures, it's a little like quenching water, quenching your thirst by drinking salt water. There's no end to it, right? There's no end to the number of friends that love you, that you can have. There's no end to the amount of wealth that you have. And if you look around, you see that that's true. That doesn't, again, mean that these things aren't valuable and that we shouldn't cultivate them. But that means that we need to continually ask, how do we put them into perspective? Because if we don't, we constantly have this feeling within ourselves that we're missing something. It's out there. Something's happening that could make me happier. Or we begin to feel more and more that people are an obstacle to us. They're the ones that are preventing us from finding our own inner resource. So what we need is we need to cultivate some sense of inner richness, something that just can't be filled by other people or external objects. We need to have a sense of getting in touch with our basic goodness, our basic unconditioned nature that isn't conditioned on any of the mundane treasures. We need to spend time moment after moment accepting ourselves. And this means more than just having a sense and cultivating a sense of being relaxed and being at ease. That's part of it. But it means looking deeply into ourselves, really looking deeply into the nature of fear and where fear comes from. And the deeper we look, we begin to have more of an insight of what Buddha called interdependent arising. Usually, if we're honest, there's me, there's the object, and that object is threatening me in some ways. It's insulting me, it's going to take something away from me, and we build up this opposition. And what Buddha said, if we can begin to see this not as two separate things, but that they're co-creating each other. You know, you and I aren't separate. We are at one level, but at another level we're not. And so this sense of like things arising together in unity, we begin to take much more of a sense of responsibility for it. There's an interesting Zen koan that I came across that I think speaks to this a little bit. It's like, this is in China, probably about the 9th century, and it was the tradition then that if somebody really exemplified themselves as being a really good teacher, that they would be nominated by the emperor as being the national teacher. In other words, the best teacher in the land. And it was also, there were a lot of stories where some teachers didn't want to accept that honor. And so then the emperor would, you know, not really give them an option. Say, no, you are, or else. But anyway, the story is this particular emperor and this particular Zen national teacher, they got a pretty good relationship, and they're walking along in a temple, and there's this stone lion. I don't exactly know what the significance was in this koan. Usually the lion represents the Dharma. The lion's roar is the Buddha's, the power of the Dharma. But the Zen teacher turns to the emperor and says, say something about the Dharma. And the emperor, he's a little shy, you know. And he says, you say something. And so the teacher says, it's my fault. What an interesting thing to say. It's my fault. You know, you expect him to say, what do you mean my fault? So when I heard that, I thought, well, this is a lot like the Lojong teachings that we've been studying, you know, the 59 slogans. And probably the hardest slogan in the Lojong, some of you are in my Lojong class, the hardest slogan is that one slogan, right, that says, drive all blames into one. you have such immediate resistance to that, you know. Like, I blame myself enough as it is. But of course, that's not what this is saying, you know. What it's saying is this thing about interdependency. The sense that even though there are things out there that I know aren't right and are causing harm, that I'm taking responsibility for how I work with that. I'm taking responsibility for whatever comes to me, how I work with that. That's what that poem is saying. But it goes a little bit deeper, and I thought I'd read a little bit about what the prologue to this koan is. You know, these traditionally have the koan, you have a little something that's said before. One of the other teachers comments on this, and then at the end there's a comment. It says, if you linger in thought, I love that, if you linger. It doesn't say if you have thought, because you're going to have thought. If you linger in thought, holding back your potential, you will remain mired in fear and frozen in inaction. If, on the other hand, you advance fearlessly and without hesitation, you manifest your power as a competent adept of the way, passing through entanglements and barriers without hindrance to time and season. A great peace is attained. How do you advance fearlessly and without hesitation? Well, the secret is to sit on your cushion and to keep coming back to your breath. Because what's happening in the past happened in the past. The future hasn't happened yet. What you have is right now. You have what's already available to you, which is the present moment. And so the more we train ourselves to do this, to come back a moment after moment, we begin to trust more and more that when the next moment is there, we're less entangled, we're less encumbered. We can just meet it with a sense of freshness. And we trust more and more. I was reading the other day about you know, us old Zen people have kind of a hard time with this new neurological way to describe meditation. But actually, it could be kind of helpful. And so I was reading this one where they had discovered this part. There's a part in the brain they knew was there called the medial prefrontal cortex. And so what they do is you take a person that is not a meditator and you tell them to sit and just follow their breath. And they notice on a brain scan that this place in your brain really lights up. It really gets very bright. But then you take a meditator and you have them sit and don't have them do anything. And you find that part of your brain is very calm. It's very cool. So what is that about? It turns out this part of your brain becomes very active when you don't give it anything to do. So if you don't have it doing something all the time, running around doing stuff, it starts to ruminate, it starts to think, and it likes particularly to think about yourself. It likes to think about what you're going to do, or it also likes to think about, like, negative things about what people have done to you. That's the part of your brain that goes into loops. This person did this to me, this is not working for me. And so in depressed people, this part of the brain can be pretty active. But it's also the part of the brain that actually creates a lot of creativity too. So there's a good part to this brain. The difference between the meditator and the non-meditator is the meditator has learned when those thoughts start to go, the meditator has trained their mind to come back to zero. The mind goes out, you come back. Mind goes out, you come back. Most people don't have that training. So they abide and they lose themselves in that medial prefrontal cortex, and it just continues to be lit up. And that's not particularly helpful to have that lit up as much as we have it lit up. You could call it that most of the time our brains are a little hot and we need to cool them down. And that's in some ways what we're doing this weekend. We're cooling our brains down a little bit. We're giving our medial prefrontal cortex. We're giving it a little training and telling it to maybe abate its normal activity. But we actually need that activity too. It's a little like going to the gym. You need to have a resistance to build up your muscle. Well, in meditation, you actually need your thoughts to be able to bring them back, to stop and come back, because that resistance is what builds up your capacity to be a meditator. Kind of interesting to think about. Anything? So the capping verse of that koan is, "The cave of the blue dragon is ominous. Only the fearless dare to enter. It is here that the forest of patterns is clearly revealed. It is here that the one ripe pearl is hidden." So we do need to see. We don't want to use meditation to dissociate from our fear. When we feel it, we need to feel it. We need to experience it. We need to ask what it's about. We need to continue to ask, because if you don't ask, it's going to go into anger, or it's going to go into dissociation. But we also need to let it go and come back to the present moment and know that there's something more, or at least a bigger container in which to hold our fear. So our fear, when we sit on the cushion, where we experience it is, one way is through our restlessness. Our fear, somebody once said, fear is the gasoline that feeds ego. And so we're so used to moving out to what's out there is where the answer is. It's that our minds, are we continually turn to move us out. The restlessness of our body continually moves to move us out. And so again and again, not always easy, we come back. We stop, we slow down, we begin to see when fear arises, and before it starts to blossom and, you know, we pour gasoline on the fire, we begin to have the capacity more to abate. But more and more, I think, in our practice, what we see is that there's nothing really that we can hang on to. And that's Buddha's ultimate solution, is we see that everything is really without a center, everything is impermanent, and everything comes and everything goes. And at first, that's a little scary to really see that. Like, where am I? You know, the mind doesn't want to stop thinking, because the mind in some ways creates that part of ourselves that we want to call ego. So it doesn't like that. So the more we can abide in that, and the more we can let the thinking brain abate a little bit, the more our basic goodness, our basic unconditioned nature can arise. And there's a deep sense of peace and trusting. And so I think we can taste that a little bit in our meditation practice, and I know you can. So probably that's enough.